supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later on the show, we'll talk about milkweed and monarchs and the other plants that attract all kinds of butterflies, but mostly with a focus on helping you see monarchs in your own backyard. We'll also talk to Dr. James Roberts from the University of South Carolina at Charleston about a very important new position paper on children and pesticides just issued by the American Academy of Pediatrics. That's a lot to get done, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Sandy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Sandy. How are you?
I'm okay, but I have a problem with thistles.
Well, where is Sandy's thistle problem?
I'm sorry, I'm in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. My property, unfortunately, or fortunately, however you may look at it, borders on county property on two sides.
Mm-hmm.
And so every year my perennial gardens become invaded with thistles.
But think of all the finches you get to come in for free without any kind of bird feeders, you know.
Well, that's true. I try to weed them out. You know, I try to get the whole root out. Because it's in my perennial bed, I don't want to use any kind of chemical in there. And it just seems like the more I try to remove them, the more come back.
There's a couple of different kind of thistles. There's bull thistle, there's Canadian thistle, which actually may be correctly Canada thistle, but some of them form underground root systems that are kind of communal, like the running bamboo plant. What you see above ground isn't so much a plant as it is a branch off of a giant underground root system. And when thistle patches in many areas have been excavated, it has been solid. It's been like somebody laid a road of these roots down there. So once they get in, they can cause a lot of mischief. First of all, have you considered putting in rhizome barrier or very deep edging around the outskirts of your property? You know, because this is the never-ending story otherwise.
Yes. I think I'm going to have to try that this year. I heard you talk to someone else about that with a different problem, something creeping in from a neighbor's yard. And, you know, because I've tried to, like, keep the area clear, like, I mow it even though it's not my property just to keep it down, but right on the edge, there's just a huge thistle patch, and I'm unable to really control that because it's county property, you know, it's free space.
Yeah, but is there any physical barrier to you going in there with a weed eater?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so you could make a mistake.
Yes, absolutely. I could lose my property line easily
you
there.
You could be out in the sun too long. You could have, oh, my, what have I done? Have I wandered beyond my property? Oh, I'm so sorry. The secret, really, the long-term secret to thistle and even to some degree plants like running bamboo is to deny them solar energy. The root system is strong, it stores a lot of nutrients, but it can only go so far without photosynthesis. So Sandy knows very well what a young thistle plant looks like, right?
Absolutely, yes.
So when the thistle plants emerge, your goal should be to allow them to grow until they develop their first true leaves.
Okay.
And then one of the easiest things to do here is kind of they make these upside down pruners where you can stand up and just lop things off. Or if you have a partner who can hold a long piece of cardboard to protect your wanted plants, you can go in with a weed whacker.
Gotcha.
But pulling the roots, I don't think is going to help you. And you can actually use that root system to exhaust itself. You can kind of rope-a-dope the thistle. You cut it all off, and then you allow it to regrow, again, until it develops its first true leaves. Then you repeat the process. Every time this happens, it's using nutrients from the root system. but it's not getting anything back. And
right.
I would suspect by the end of the season, these thistle plants will be very weak and spindly. And by the time we get to next year, over the winter, after the soil
right.
freezes hard, I would
right.
suggest you put down a really good mulch of 2 inches of shredded leaves. And then
right.
in the spring, any stragglers are going to come up very weak and leggy. And then you could either continue to do the cutting for a little bit, or here's a case where you could then use a flame weeder, a small handheld propane flame weeder, or get some high-strength horticultural vinegar. And these plants will have very little energy. They'll be very leggy. They'll be very starved for light. They'll realize you don't care for them personally. And by the middle of that second season, you should be good to go.
Well, that's a great help because I was completely baffled. I've tried everything. But that's what I'll do next year. I'll just starve them.
Very good.
Okay, thanks so much.
Good luck, Sandy.
All right, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I listen to your show every week.
Well, I thank you, Jill. I wish that should be a requirement of being an American citizen, but I'm glad you're right there ready to get your papers. Where are you?
I'm in Springboro, Ohio.
And is that in the Dayton area?
It's just a little south of Dayton.
Okay. So what can we do for Jill?
Well, I have planted 5 fruit trees in my front yard.
Oh, you're looking for trouble. Yeah.
I know. And in front of that, I have a bunch of raised beds, and the water, when it rains, all drains off my house into the corner where one of the fruit trees is.
That's bad.
Yeah, and it's not possible to really put in any drainage.
Is the water draining from a gutter spout?
It's draining from everything. Now that the raised beds are in, we have paving around it.
Right.
So it all kind of rushes down the paving and kind of goes onto the one corner. The rest of the trees are fine, but water sits around this one.
Okay. And did you tell me what kind of tree you're drowning?
It's a plum tree. Now, I had a local landscaper come and look at it, and he said, well, throw sand around it gradually, and the roots will come up.
Yeah.
And my husband said, oh, that's a great idea. That'll be inexpensive. We'll just throw sand on it. And that sounds totally silly to me. I'm thinking we need to, since it's only been there 2 years, kind of maybe dig up one half of it, put dirt under it to kind of raise it.
Men. And you're no better. No, it has to. It can't stay in this room anymore. It must be moved. But I tell you, it's really easy to move plants in soaking wet soil. So I think it's going to come up real easy for you, Jilski.
Okay.
Now, you're in Ohio. So you're going to get a lot of cold weather. You're going to get a lot of freezing temps. You're going to get some good solid frost. Your ground is going to be frozen hard for a good part of the winter. And all your deciduous trees have shed their leaves. Everything should be nice and close to dormant right now. And all these fruit trees have nice big buds on them, right?
Yes, they do, even this one.
What I think you should do, first of all, find a new place for it. You got to have a new place for it. Even if it's at somebody else's house, it can't stay there.
Okay.
You know. So do you have another area on your landscape where you can transplant it?
Yes.
Okay, so you got 2 choices. Your first choice would be if your ground is not frozen solid now, or you go through a nice little thaw, if you can dig the new hole now, you would, of course, follow the rules for good tree planting. You would dig a wide hole, not a deep one. You would not amend the soil in the hole with anything special. You want the roots to spread out. And
okay.
then after you have the tree replanted, you can mulch around it with 2 inches of compost or shredded leaves, if that makes you happy. Keep wood mulch, especially, away from fruit trees. And then after you get this hole dug, which is the important part, because you don't want to get the tree out of the ground and then realize you can't dig a hole over on the other side of the yard. Then you get a couple of guys with shovels, get underneath it as much as they can. I would prefer to do this in January. Try to get up a big island of earth. Because the soil has been soaked repeatedly and is constantly wet, it's going to come up easier than a lot of other plants. And they may do some root pruning. But as long as it's dormant, the tree should survive. Your other option, which I think would work equally well, would be to wait till the trees flower, because that's when, around that time, right before they flower, during the time they flower, right after they flower, is when you have to prune them. And whether you have pruned your fruit trees or not, by this year, you must start pruning them. So there okay. might be an advantage here if you wait until the trees are, let's say, because of this unique situation, right before they flower. If you were to move it then, as it's starting to put on some new growth. Actually, I'm going to change my mind. Let's wait till after the flowers fade, and then we're going to move it, because that's when it's growing the most rapidly. That's when it has the most vigor. Move it over to the new position. It may mess with the fruits a little bit for this year, but a three-year-old tree, you're probably going to want to strip most, if not all, of any developing fruits anyway. So your two options would be in the middle of winter or in spring, right around flowering time. That's when these things can be moved the easiest.
Okay, wonderful.
All right, Jill?
Thank you so much.
All right, good luck.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that those of you with 17 minutes to kill can now view the video of my recent TEDx talk describing how best to achieve the magical transformation of fall leaves into garden gold and explaining why some leaf blowers really don't suck. But don't go clicking on the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, just yet, because we'll be back with an important warning from the American Academy of Pediatrics about children and pesticides and how to get the most monarch butterflies in your backyard. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little later in the show, we're going to talk about attracting butterflies to your backyard, specifically monarchs. And if you think the secret is only milkweed, you better stay tuned. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our very special guest, Dr. James Roberts, professor of pediatrics at the Medical University of South Carolina at Charleston and director of the South Carolina Pediatric Research Network. Dr. Roberts, along with Dr. Catherine Carr, the University of Washington, is the lead author of a very important policy statement just issued by the American Academy of Pediatrics addressing the health effects of pesticide use on children. Dr. Roberts, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Now, the Academy's policy statement itself runs 8 pages, and the technical report that backs it up is 25 pages long with 195 references. Can you simplify this a bit for us and tell us exactly what you were looking for in terms of the effects of pesticide exposure on children?
We try to look at the whole gamut. We look at acute pesticide exposure, acute pesticide poisoning, symptoms related to acute pesticide poisoning, and then we also look at chronic exposure, and that can be both a subacute level of exposure over a long period of time and then subsequent chronic effects. Sometimes you can get chronic effects following acute poisoning as well, so there's really the whole gamut of that.
So we're talking about not only the lawns that children would play on, but people's, to me, very bizarre habit of having their homes sprayed for insects on a regular basis. One of the things the Academy seems to recognize is the parents aren't really thinking about the potential results that that can have on their children.
That's correct. I have to say, living down in South Carolina, I do understand the concept of wanting to spray because the cockroaches here are very, very large,
mm-hmm.
and we like to get rid of them. But parents can be using insecticides or other pesticides daily, both in their house, in the gardens, on their pets, the material that we put on the back of our dogs and cats' shoulder blades for fleas is another pesticide, and certainly through the diet. And so you've got multiple exposures, multiple routes of exposure that you have to deal with.
One of the stunning things in the policy statement was that you found the diet of children to be one of the heaviest pesticide exposures and that you were detecting all these pesticides in their urine.
What you're referring to is especially one particular article that looks at kids who were fed a regular diet, had their pesticide residues measured, and then fed an organic diet, and then went back on the conventional diet, and they showed a drop in the pesticide residues when they were on the organic diet, and then a rise in the pesticide residues again following that. There really are not a whole lot of studies available on kids and pesticide exposure. And so that was one of the main ones that we found that we wanted to point out. But that really points out exposure levels. It doesn't really discuss outcomes, which a large number of cohort and case control studies do look at.
What were the biggest effects that you were able to trace back to pesticide use that you saw in children?
The technical report covers neurologic and neurodevelopmental disorders, cancer, asthma, birth defects, other birth outcomes, including low birth weight, and then some endocrine effects. From our review of the literature, I think that the two areas that probably had the best level or best amount of evidence were for cancer outcomes, particularly leukemia, which would be acute lymphocytic leukemia in children, and also brain tumors. And then the other area was in neurodevelopmental outcomes or neurodevelopmental delay. Looking at cancer, we looked at a number of case control and cohort studies and found that children whose parents were exposed when the infant was actually in utero, those mothers who had exposure to pesticides through their home, garden, or work use had a higher risk for leukemia and cancer and other cancers than those who did not have the same exposure. Likewise, we did find some studies that also pointed out higher risks of cancer among those whose parents had agricultural-type jobs.
No one would be shocked by the fact that farm workers or people who work with chemicals would have these unfortunate outcomes. But you're clearly also saying that the science links it to people who are just using pesticides in their homes.
That's actually one of, I think, an important finding to understand, is that commonly we think of farm workers as the area of risk for pesticide exposure. And to a large extent, that is true. But what we're trying to point out is that, to some degree, some of the exposures of concern happen in the home and from home use and outdoor use around their yard.
So this is a policy statement adopted by the American Academy of Pediatrics at the end of November. In a nutshell, what do you hope to accomplish?
One of the areas that I really wanted to point out is that for acute exposures or acute poisonings, we want to make sure that pediatricians can recognize clinical signs and symptoms of acute intoxication. This is important because in some of the past studies that have looked at series of children who were poisoned by organophosphates, 80% of the kids who were sent to a referral hospital were sent there with the wrong diagnosis. So clinicians certainly have room for improvement to identify acute pesticide poisoning. We also want to have pediatricians be familiar with the chronic exposures and the clinical outcomes. We want pediatricians to be able to know what kinds of resources for toxicity management they should be looking for. We want them to understand what's involved in a pesticide label. We want pediatricians to be willing and able to ask parents about pesticide use in the home and the garden. And we want pediatricians to be willing and able to work with schools and governmental agencies to advocate for least toxic pesticide use using what's called integrated pest management.
I get the sense from your work that the children's exposure to pesticide and the negative effects of that is far greater than anyone has realized.
Hopefully the people who read this find this a little eye-opening, that they might learn something new, that they didn't realize that there are a lot of data out there about pesticides and children's exposures, and hopefully it can be a little bit more well-accepted as something to be concerned about.
And now I think I'll be more comfortable when parents have a question saying, ask your pediatrician about that. Ask them the position of the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Sure. I hope so.
Well, thank you for your fine work. We've been talking with Dr. James Roberts, a professor of pediatrics at the Medical University of South Carolina at Charleston, who, along with Dr. Catherine Carr from the University of Washington, co-authored a policy statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics that could do a lot of good towards getting kids and pesticides further apart in our world. Dr. Roberts, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
And now, back to your phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Judy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Hello, Judy. How are you?
Good.
And where is Judy Good?
In Muncie, Indiana.
Oh, very good. What a pleasure to hear from you. What can we do for you?
I have a Japanese red maple. And the other day, looking at it, I noticed that on almost all of the branches, it looked like wounds. And I had noticed that my little birds had been sitting up in the trees, and it looked like they were using the branch to sharpen their beak or wipe their beak. And I think that's what's created this indentation in the bark.
Now, what part of the tree are we talking about? Are we talking about the trunk, the branches?
Nope, the branches.
Okay.
The branches. And I have seen the birds sitting up there and doing this activity. And so I put bird netting over the red maple.
Okay.
And then they moved on to my dogwood, which is not far from the maple, and they're sitting there and they're doing the same thing.
Okay.
And it's causing these little, look like little blisters
right,
on which, the tree branches.
Right, which we actually don't know if they're going to do any harm or not. Now, this is interesting. How old are these trees?
Well, the dogwood is quite old, over 20 years, but the red maple is about 5 years old.
I hear this a lot about birds nibbling away or scratching away or doing this, especially young trees, because the bark of very young trees can be very tasty.
Uh-huh.
And maples are like the Chuck Wepner of the garden world. They are bleeders. Uh-huh. So as you like slice into a maple with your beak, you're going to get, uh-huh, you're going to get what? You're going to get maple sugar.
Oh.
So,
even the Japanese maples?
Yes. All maples, quote, sugar to some degree. Obviously, some trees sugar very heavily. And the trees that are tapped for maple sugar are never damaged. So my prediction is on the red maple, they would not have done the tree any harm. Very curious that they've moved over to, what did you say they moved over to?
Yeah, a dogwood.
Right, which is not necessarily known for its sap, but it might be a sappy tree. What kind of birds?
They are mostly sparrows, although I have seen my Carolina wren do do that a little bit.
Oh, okay. Carolina wren is a meat eater, honey. Carolina wren is like almost 100% carnivore. They're one of my favorite birds.
Oh, yes.
I attract them to my trees because I know they will go into my trees and eat bugs that are overwintering under the bark. So this is a complex situation. As long as you bought the netting and you threw it on top, you might as well leave it on top of the maple.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to try to protect the dogwood, there's a very inexpensive product you can buy called Bird Scare Flash Tape.
Okay.
Just search those four words together. You'll be amazed at how many retailers carry it. It's very inexpensive. I see it in a lot of independent garden stores, even in the spring. Of course, right now, everything is dancing reindeer and inflatable Homer Simpson Santa Clauses. But Bird Scare Flash Tape is easily available, comes in a roll like old reel-to-reel tape, and you just hang it from the tree. And anytime there's even the slightest breeze, even a breeze that we can't feel, it goes whipping into the air. And it makes all these different noises. It makes like six different sounds. It snaps, it cracks, it whistles. And it reflects light in really bizarre ways. So it does all of the things that confuse birds, and it does them really randomly. So it's very difficult for birds to get used to. First of all, I would not obsess about it. The test is going to be in the spring. If there's any problem with these trees leafing out, then we have to move to phase two. But I predict they're going to leaf out beautifully and give you everything that you expect from them. And you get to bird watch at the same time.
Well, thank you, Mike.
All right. Good luck, Judy. 1-888-346-9499. Siva, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks
yes.
for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. How are you?
Great. Thank you very much. How about you?
I'm doing good. Where are you?
I am at Newark, Delaware.
Oh, yes, of course. Newark, Delaware. Actually, I'm supposed to pronounce it Newark, right? I've been told that by a couple of listeners down there.
That's true.
All right. What can we do for Siva in Newark, Delaware?
I have a question about using cardboards as weed blockers.
Right. Using cardboard. As weed block in the garden. That's something that I recommend when people are building their raised beds.
I have got the same advice from some organic farmers, and I have laid the cardboards, put compost on top of it, and hay on top of it, and let it decompose naturally on my flower, on my raised beds. I thought of doing it on my flower beds around the home. Then I read that cardboards are made of cellulose, and they attract termites. So is it a good idea to use cardboards around the house?
Well, that is an excellent question. You're absolutely right. Cardboard contains cellulose, and cellulose is what termites eat pretty much exclusively. There's cellulose in cardboard. There's cellulose in wood. You know, anything that is wood or used to be wood, and of course cardboard is a late down the road byproduct of wood, made from wood. Do these things attract termites? Maybe, maybe not. Will termites eat cardboard and wood, especially buried underground? Absolutely. Termites are ubiquitous. They are absolutely everywhere. So you can't freak out. You're not going to lure termites to your backyard, because I guarantee there are termites in your backyard. They're just everywhere. And the fact that our houses aren't continually collapsing is a good sign that their presence is not an immediate threat. The best way to keep termites away from your house is not to have anything next to your house. The best termite prevention, better than a chemical trench, is to have a foot-wide area of open space all around your home, because what termites need more than anything is moist soil to travel through. So any kind of mulch, whether it be cardboard covered with soil, whether it would be wood chips, whether it would be stones, anything that keeps the underground soil constantly moist makes travel for termites not only possible but very attractive. They will follow moisture before they will seek out wood or cellulose. So the important thing is not to have anything growing or covering the soil right next to your home, because all you need is that 1 foot of open space. Termites cannot travel underneath dry ground. They dry out very quickly, and they won't go into soil that's not moist. But because you haven't done this already, because you're just thinking about it, we have an amazing opportunity. You can actually do the cardboard trick of weed suppression and at the same time build a termite barrier around your house. Now, it'll involve you getting some boric acid and making a very weak solution of boric acid. Boric acid is a very safe substance. We use it as an eye wash, but it's toxic even in small doses to ants and termites. So I'm going to send you to our website, to youbetyourgarden.org. I want you to look under T for termites. And there it'll give you a formula that you can use to make a very weak solution of boric acid. Soak the cardboard that you're going to use as your weed block in a weak solution of boric acid, then install it. And any termites that nibble on that cardboard will take pieces of it back to the nest where it'll be fed to the queen. And after the boric acid builds up in their bodies for 5 to 9 days, it'll actually kill the queen and wipe out that entire colony of termites.
This is a great suggestion. I would follow it up immediately.
All right, you take care, man.
You too.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind our listeners who have a cut Christmas tree in the house to keep that water reservoir filled. If you let it go completely dry, even for a few hours, the tree may lose its ability to take up moisture and drop so many needles you'll need to wear Kevlar socks. But don't go crawling down low under your tannenbaum just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how to have the maximum number of monarchs in your backyard. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, monarch butterflies are an amazing phenomena of nature. They fly thousands of miles back and forth from Mexico up to the top of the United States, back down again. How do you get them to stop in your backyard? How do you help them procreate? It's not all about milkweed, believe it or not. We'll tell you what it is about after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jake, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Jake. How are you?
Pretty good.
And where is Jake pretty good?
Ada, Oklahoma.
What part of Oklahoma, Jake?
Ada.
Ada, I don't know that. Is that in the Oklahoma City, Norman area?
It's south of Oklahoma City, about 80 miles.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Jake?
I took on a home hydroponic system for a hobby, and I was trying to grow some little garden things, tomatoes and things like that, and I'm guessing what is root rot. And I think I'm guessing it's probably because I filled my reservoir up too far. But I was also wondering about lighting. I have a 90-watt LED light, and I was wondering if that was powerful enough to grow big tomatoes.
That's not powerful enough to read a book by, Jake.
Yeah, well, that's what I was afraid of. How many watts would I need then?
Oh, man. The high-intensity lights that are used for indoor growing, there are sodium vapor and metal halide. I always get them confused. But when I had a greenhouse and was growing plants over the winter for the Philadelphia Flower Show, I used one of each because they gave off different kind of spectrums of light. And one of them was 400 watts. The other one was 1,000 watts. And I think you are on a path. Should you achieve success, should you go out and now buy the recommended high-intensity lights, no matter how much more efficient they've gotten over the years, and run them for long enough and provide the electricity, I think you may achieve that elusive goal of growing the $862 tomato.
Yeah?
Yes, I think.
So I probably need at least 400 watts, you think?
Well, not only that, but I think you are fighting nature. Even when the Dutch do this over the winter in their glass houses and their greenhouses, they are still using outdoor light. Everything is open to the outside so that as much sun as possible gets in. And then that is also supplemented with very expensive artificial light. It takes an enormous amount of energy. And I will tell you, because I do use my 400 watt for a couple of hours, like 4 hours a night, to keep my pepper plants and birds of paradise alive on a big insulated porch. And a 400 watt light run for about 8 hours a day could probably sustain 4 well-placed tomato plants. Sustain them in the sense that they would get enough light and energy to flower and fruit.
With the 400 watt?
With the 400 watt, and the placement would be important. But you do understand you're putting more money into buying the material and paying for the energy to run it. You could buy 4 times as many tomatoes in a supermarket, maybe 100 times as many.
Oh, I see.
See, I don't like hydroponically because there's nothing about hydroponic gardening that a little dirt wouldn't improve. You can do container gardening. You can grow in good soil indoors over the winter, especially if you're going to pop for a 400-watt high-intensity light. But to be smart, you would grow salad greens and lettuces and spinaches and things that don't require as much light and energy.
Thanks.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Thank you. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yes, sir. How are you?
I'm doing good. Bob, how are you, sir?
Doing fine.
And where is Bob fine?
Bob is in Mount Juliet, Tennessee.
All right, sir. Very good. Very good. What can we do you for?
Well, I have a small orchard on a little farm that I have in Lebanon, Tennessee. And I'm not up there every day, but I'm up there as often as I can. But I'm really having a problem with wood borers and deer and other insects. They're getting into, the deer are coming in, and the young bucks are taking their horns and just destroying my trees. They probably killed about, I'd say, about 30 of them so far. And I have sprayed the trees for the wood borers. And I was told to use Esfenvalerate, but I can't get that because I don't have that permit.
And luckily for you.
But I have been using Borer Minor Killer.
Nah, see, I don't know any of these toxic things, man.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I can tell you is it may not be impossible to be a long-distance orchard owner, but you can see impossible from there. Fruit trees require the most care, the most attention, and there's really no substitute for the daily walk. Now, I'll tell you right away that, especially when they're young, but even when they're a fairly decent size, fruit trees need winter protection from deer. It can be as simple as chicken wire wrapped around the trunks of the trees. You can buy professional tree guards. You can make them, you know, bend some thin sheet metal. But you need a physical protection against deer, and that's whether you're there or not.
Yes.
Now, do you prune the trees heavily every late winter, early spring?
You know, I pruned one of my peach trees, and the section that I pruned, about two-thirds of the tree died.
Well, when did you prune it?
I think it was like in the fall of the year.
Yeah, no, that's the absolute wrong time of year. So you didn't read up on anything first. You're just freehanding this.
Well, I try to read up on it, but I don't have that much material to read up on.
What I want you to do is I want you to go to our website. I want you to go to youbetyourgarden.org and A to Z, Garden Answers A to Z. Under the letter F are two really simple but very informative short pieces about getting started with fruit trees. Never prune them in the fall. They've already set their fruit in the fall. So you want to prune them in the spring, right before they flower, during their flowering time, right after they flower. You also have to thin the developing fruits on apples and peaches. You have to spend a huge amount of time in the orchard removing at least three-quarters of the developing fruits if you want to get marketable fruits.
Yes, sir.
And you need to grow them in a rich soil, fortified with compost, and you need to keep weeds and grass down around them. But you really should do all of this without any kind of chemical inputs. Fruit trees really despise chemical fertilizers, for instance, and it attracts insects like borers and the various caterpillars and creatures that then bore into the fruits.
Well, I read where if you put a young seedling tree in the ground and just cover the roots with dirt and then top that with sand, and that is supposed to be a good deterrent for insects.
Yeah, well, I read that aliens came down and shot President Kennedy. That's ridiculous. There's no reason for that to happen, Bob. And unfortunately, with fruit trees, there's no substitute for hard work. Fruit trees require more attention from me. I'm down to about 6 or 8 peach trees now, down from a dozen, because I could not personally care for a dozen. And those 6 or 8 peach trees take twice as much time as all the rest of my garden, as 1,000 square feet of raspberries, as all the dozens of tomato plants and pepper plants and salad greens. They are the most time-consuming crop, and you got to do it right.
Yes, they are time-consuming. I found that out.
You have to prune them at the right time of year. You have to thin the fruits. But then after that, once the fruits are thinned, there is an organic control called surround. That is a micronized clay spray. You're actually spraying clay onto the leaves and the fruits. And it's miraculous. The fruits develop better than if you hadn't done it. And the little bit of clay keeps insects away, and they don't mess with your fruits. In your case, if you're having borer problems, you could spray the bark of the tree as well. And
right.
This time of year, I would also urge you to hang suet feeders throughout your orchard. That'll bring in the meat-eating birds that naturally go after these borers and pull them out of the tree before they can do any harm. Protect them from deer over the winter. Treat them organically. You got to get on the right pruning and thinning schedule and surround, and you'll get some darn good fruit from that alone.
Okay.
All right, Bob?
Yes, sir.
All right, good luck, sir.
It's nice talking with you.
You too.
Yes, sir. Goodbye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, which we're calling of milkweed and monarchs. You Bet Your Garden producer Larry Roebling. Read this week's questions, please.
We heard from Regina of Wilmington, Delaware, who wrote, "A few years ago, I planted some milkweed seeds that I got from a nonprofit organization promoting monarch butterfly conservation. The milkweed grew and spread like crazy through the underground roots. However, it's very tall and droopy, never flowers, attracts very few butterflies, and is extremely unattractive. I see one or two caterpillars on the plants every year, but after a few days, they disappear. I assume they're being eaten? I'm very disappointed and am considering digging it all out. Any ideas?" And we also heard from James in Flemington, New Jersey. "Alfred Hitchcock got it right. The birds have turned against me. As soon as my tomatoes turn red, they peck holes in them. More importantly, I have beautiful varieties of milkweed that attract lots of monarchs. The monarchs lay eggs, the eggs hatch, and the caterpillars grow. Then they disappear. And my wrens look very well fed. Do cultivars of milkweed eventually lose the yucky taste that repels birds from devouring monarch caterpillars? Thanks."
Unfortunately, the toxins in the milkweed plant aren't as poisonous as people think, explains Ron Ryle, an urban butterfly enthusiast and author of a book on attracting butterflies, who tries to lure as many winged wonders as possible to his Pottstown, Pennsylvania backyard. "I've lost as many as 18 monarch caterpillars feeding on milkweed in one day," he says, "and wrens are a big predator. But loss is the norm. A monarch egg has a very slim chance of producing an adult butterfly. And this summer was especially hard on the Madron. The warm weather brought out a lot of predators and parasites. I especially noticed a lot of flies attacking the eggs and young caterpillars. Interestingly, houseflies will die afterwards, but that doesn't stop them." Ron explains that his backyard is only 50 by 50, but he jams a lot of plants in there, and over the years has learned which ones really attract the most butterflies. "The legendary butterfly bush, Bedelia, is great," he explains, "but it needs a few years to get to a big enough size to attract good numbers. The real winner for me, especially for monarchs, is Tithonia, commonly known as Mexican sunflower. It's native to Mexico, as are the monarchs, and they really seem to recognize it. If you want to see a lot of monarchs, plant a lot of Tithonia." "Milkweed," he continues, "is mostly a host plant. It's what the monarch caterpillars feed on. You install lots of milkweed in the hopes of attracting the egg-laying adults, who show up here around the end of June. Those adults will also feed on the nectar in the milkweed flowers, but their bloom season is really short. Each type only flowers for about a month. And this year it was even shorter. Milkweed just doesn't like to bloom well in the heat. The basic orange-flowering milkweed, commonly known as butterfly weed, does best in terrible soil with very little nutrition," he explains. "You often see it growing in the stones along railroad tracks. If you want it to thrive in your garden, plant it in 50% sand and don't feed it. Common milkweed, which has pink flowers, is hard to grow from seed, so you might want to start with plants. And swamp milkweed may be the best choice for getting adults to lay a lot of eggs. It does prefer a moist soil, but unlike its common name, it doesn't require a swamp. Now, the young caterpillars are really small," he continues, "so females prefer to lay their eggs on milkweed plants with the kind of small, tender leaves that are easy for them to eat. The eggs are about the size of a pencil point, are laid singly, and hatch in about 4 days. Because of the high risk of predation, I bring my eggs and tiny caterpillars inside into clean cages," he continues, "and feed them fresh milkweed leaves. They grow fast inside, and I release them as adults, who always fly southwest. Watch closely if you do this, because they fly very high and are quickly out of sight." Ron explains that he's part of the Monarch Watch butterfly tagging program out of the University of Kansas, which is how he knows that a monarch he tagged on September 20th, 2003, ended up in El Rosario, Mexico in 2004, after flying 2,038 miles. The monarchs migrating back to Mexico pass through our part of the country from early September through the first week of October, he notes, adding that September 20th through the 24th is typically the peak season in his Pottstown garden, during which he'll see 100 monarchs or so a day. But look fast to see them, he adds. Migrating monarchs only stop in a backyard for about a minute and a half each. And they'll only land on flowering plants in full sun and greatly prefer Tithonia at a rate of 10 to 1 over butterfly bush. You can learn lots more at monarchwatch.org or from Ron's book, Attracting Butterflies, A Handbook for Butterfly Gardening. Oh, and although it's pronounced like you're all riled up, Ron's last name is spelled R-I-C-H-A-E-L. Well, that sure was some interesting information about those magical monarchs and the plants that sustain them now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it over in all of its high-flying glory. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to mince my milkweed if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like the one you're emailing me about, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. Watch the video of my recent TEDx talk, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and or like us on Facebook already. Oi! Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin Don't Call Me Merv Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Larry Roebling is our sensational substitute producer, as Alexis Landis, who normally produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, continues her maternity leave caring for Ari, the official cute baby of You Bet Your Garden. Our social media director, Amanda McGrath, wants to know if the butterflies get cookies with that milkweed. Ace production assistant Brett Rader wishes he could migrate down south for the winter. Road trip to Mexico, shouts our esteemed editor, Al Banks. I'd be lucky if I made it to Maryland, Mike McGrath. But I'll have a little shot at Tithonia, and maybe I'll see you next week. Ready for some holiday greenery that's really green? I'm Mike McGrath, and the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden is our annual Christmas Spectacular, featuring lots of fun facts about holiday plants and seasonal tunes from Ken Queter and the Reindeer Band.